And as Lucien said, I did my undergraduate here at the University of Waterloo back in the 90s in physics, a great place to study. I see a lot of students here now. I guess it's an understatement to say that this is a very different place than it was back in the 90s with the Perimeter Institute and the IQC and all this exciting stuff going on in quantum computing. So it's great to be back, and thanks everyone for letting me tell you a bit about some of the quantum computing research that I'm doing down in Sydney. Okay, so the research group we have at Sydney is a relatively new one, but we're growing fast. It's a large group now with both theory and experiment working on quantum computing and related aspects, as well as some foundations of quantum mechanics. We're part of a center called Center of Excellence for Engineered Quantum Systems. And I'm going to talk to you today about some of the theory work that we're doing in terms of understanding the requirements for doing quantum computation. And so I first of all want to highlight the students and collaborators that are doing the work on this project. We have some very bright students, Dominic Else and Andrew Dharmawan, who've done a lot of the detailed work I'm going to show to you today. This is work in collaboration with Andrew Doherty, who's at Sydney, as well as Gavin Brennan, down the road at Macquarie University in Sydney, Aki Masamiyaki, who's here and you all know, and Joe Rennes in Germany. Okay, so my talk today is about quantum computation, and so let me just start with a few broad words about what that is. It's predicted, just from following the structure of quantum mechanics, that we should be able to drive a very controlled quantum system in a very exotic way to do computation, to do quantum logic, and that a computer built on quantum rules, which processes information at that microscopic level, might be able to do more powerful things than computers today can do. And so there's been a worldwide effort to see if we can construct such a quantum computing device and to try to understand what we can do with it. And I'm going to be talking a bit about the theory of trying to understand what we need to do in order to do quantum computation, to make a quantum system allow us to compute in one of these exotic new ways. So what would a quantum computer be? An analogy which I like to use is that a quantum computer is very much like Schrödinger's cat. So Schrödinger's cat is this bizarre thought experiment developed by Schrödinger to sort of show the ridiculousness of applying quantum mechanics to the macroscopic world, and it leads through a chain of events starting with the decay of an atom to a cat being in a superposition of alive and dead. In many ways, we think of a quantum computer as a realization of Schrödinger's cat, that we can create a system in a macroscopic quantum state that ultimately will allow us to do computation. And this analogy, I think, is quite deep in that, so much like Schrödinger's cat, we understand quantum computation by following the rules of quantum mechanics, just applying them to larger and larger systems in sequence. Quantum mechanical rules that we know work very well for subatomic systems and applying them into just the natural extension to a very large regime. But like Schrödinger's cat, it seems that we don't see quantum computers in nature, and this is the big struggle, is to try to isolate such systems from the environment, to put them in this highly isolated state such that we can maintain this quantum coherence and have a system exist in a way that it would not naturally, would not at equilibrium with its environment. So that's the analogy I use, and like a lot of analogies, if you think really, really hard about it, you'll ultimately find that your great analogy probably has some fundamental flaws to it, and is just outright wrong if you push it too far. And that's what I'm going to try to argue today, is that that analogy might break down and hopefully will break down, because that might make building a quantum computer a much easier task. So in analogy to Schrödinger's cat, we would think of a quantum computer as being a highly non-classical, very far from equilibrium state that is going to be very difficult to create on a macroscopic level. There's been some already some suggestions in the literature in very different types of model of quantum computation, adiabatic quantum computing, topological quantum computing, that maybe that's actually not necessary, that we might be able to do quantum computing with systems that are at equilibrium with their environment, and that we might have a quantum computer operate in a regime that's very different from that Schrödinger cat, constantly be interacting with its environment, but nonetheless still able to process information in this exotic new way. And that's what I want to try to convince you of today, is some results that show that this might be possible in the systems that we think of as viable for quantum computing. Okay, so can a quantum computer be a far from equilibrium state? Maybe even a more extreme question would be, can we have quantum computation in the equilibrium state of some system? Now, at room temperature, we look around at what are the equilibrium states. We see solids, liquids, gases, not very much quantum behavior. What we've known for a long time is we cool systems down to very low temperature, we can have some quite exotic quantum behavior emerge naturally at equilibrium in those systems, just very low temperatures. Things like superconductivity, definitely a quantum effect that has all sorts of long-range coherent properties to it. More exotic things like the fractional quantum Hall effect with its predictions for fractionalized particles or anions, and systems like quantum magnetism, where magnets go into the little tiny domains or spins of your system go into highly entangled superposition states rather than the normal product states of a ferromagnet. So we can have exotic quantum effects at equilibrium. And so the question is, can we add quantum computers to this list? Can we think of a system where to make it into a quantum computer, all we have to do is cool it down to a sufficiently low temperature, and voila, the quantum computational power just emerges. Okay, well, you may be comfortable with thinking of superconductivity as a type of equilibrium state of matter, but what does it even mean to say my low temperature system is a quantum computer? Let me try to just give you a perspective that this is not such a strange idea. A lot of equilibrium systems we describe by how they respond to some perturbation. So their response to, say, an external magnetic field or some compression or something like that, see how that system responds, and that's how we can actually talk about a state of matter being a liquid or a gas or something else that's more exotic. What would a quantum computer be if it was some low temperature equilibrium state? Well, again, this is a system that's going to respond in a particular way to a perturbation. The perturbation we want is somehow encoding our question, and its response is going to be the output of that computation. Now, we might actually break this argument down a bit and think of individual components of a system acting in a much more simple way, basically doing simple logic gates or something in the terms of this language of some perturbation and response, much like a classical computer is made of transistors. Now, here we have an equilibrium state of a material, a semiconductor, that responds in a particular way to electric impulses. Maybe we can have the same sort of thing for a quantum system. Okay, so I think it makes sense to think about states of matter, equilibrium states, as giving you the potential to do computation. What types of systems could we imagine doing this? I'm not suggesting that we go out in nature and just find one, but there's a range of recent experiments where we're building up quantum systems, from the bottom up, single quantum system at a time, and coupling them together, and we're able to control what that coupling is. So rather than going out and finding a system and saying, what's its Hamiltonian that describes its equilibrium dynamics, we can say, well, what Hamiltonian do you want? And I'll dial one up in one of these devices, these controllable devices. There's a whole range of things, and I'm not going to talk about the implementations of this type of thing, but I can talk about designer Hamiltonians and say, well, can I make a system behave in a way that as is described by that Hamiltonian? Okay, and there's a final requirement in order for this idea to make sense. So states of matter, as we think of them, have a natural robustness to them. We talked about a superconductor being a low temperature state that exhibits quantum phenomena but is at equilibrium. An important property of superconductivity is that you don't care what electron number 4,876 is doing. You're interested in general properties of how that system behaves, general properties of its Hamiltonian, and it's robust against those precise microscopic details. We would like that same sort of thing for a quantum computational state of matter, that it has a natural robustness and doesn't depend in a fine-tuned way on these exotic Hamiltonians that we're going to devise. And those of you working in the field of quantum computing might say, well, isn't this robustness what quantum error correction is supposed to correct for? I mean, maybe we already have a solution to this problem. Well, there's two aspects of this. One is that quantum error correction, as we know it, is very much on measuring individual microscopic systems to get a syndrome and to do some microscopic correction on those systems. And so it goes against a bit against the nature of the exercise here of talking about some equilibrium state that we are manipulating with macroscopic perturbations. And also the fact that perturbations in a Hamiltonian of the system don't match up very well with the types of noise models for which we have good quantum error correction techniques. So those noise models typically rely on independent stochastic errors, and a perturbation in a Hamiltonian is a highly correlated error across your system that doesn't naturally fit in within that framework. So it's quite a non-trivial question to ask about the robustness of such a state. Okay, so let me outline what I'm going to talk about in this colloquium today. I'm going to give you some arguments that this idea of quantum computational matter, of a robust phase of matter at low temperature that has quantum computational power, makes some sense. We're interested in low temperature behavior, and we know low temperature behavior is governed by properties of the ground state. So for the purpose of this talk, I'm going to restrict my attention to ground state properties, though the hope is that all of these ideas will apply to low temperature thermal states as well, as long as that temperature is low enough. So in everything I do from now on, I'll be interested in ground state properties. Okay, so here's what I'm going to present to you in the talk today. I'm going to discuss a toy model in one dimension that has some of the characteristics of this quantum computational matter, and we'll get some feeling for what this means and the fact that such a phase can exist. And then I'm going to, in the second half of the talk, focus on some more realistic systems, and in particular, antiferromagnets in one and two dimensions, and to show some very promising theoretical ideas that say quantum computing with the equilibrium state of some spin chain is not such a crazy idea. Okay, so I said I'm going to start off with a toy model that's going to illustrate the essential ideas. This is the portion of the talk where I'll give the most technical results. It's some work with my student Dominic and Andrew Doherty. Okay, so there's a natural framework in which to even pose these questions of how do I take the state of a quantum many-body system and think about using it for quantum computing. And that's a framework proposed 10 years ago now called cluster state quantum computing or measurement-based quantum computing. And the idea of quantum computing in this type of model is that rather than the typical perspective of quantum computing as evolution under the Schrödinger equation, that Schrödinger evolution is driving the dynamics of the computer to do its computation, we're going to think of driving dynamics through measurement, through wave function collapse. We're going to do a sequence of measurements on a quantum many-body system that and following the update rules for measuring parts of quantum states, we're going to drive the remaining unmeasured qubits into some particular state which represents our computation. So to do measurement-based quantum computing, what you need is some resource state, some system of many spins or many particles of which you can subject to your measurements. And you need it in a particular entangled state in order to drive that computation. And the standard one we use is the so-called cluster state, which I'll define in a one-dimensional example shortly. We should think of this cluster state as like one of these breadboards that you used to do electronics with back in high school. It has the potential to be any circuit that you want, and we're going to wire up the particular computation we want through our choice of measurements on that particular state. Okay, and we can think of these resource states as being constructed by some quantum computer, or appearing as ground states of some many-body quantum system that has these desired entanglement properties. And that's going to be the connection with these low-temperature states of matter, equilibrium states, or ground states, is that we're thinking of such a resource as appearing as the ground state of some system, and then we're going to ask about properties of that resource. Now, this idea of subjecting individual systems to measurements doesn't match well with this perspective of a phase of matter of which I'm only subjecting to more bulk external perturbations. But we have a nice mapping, actually, from this model to an equivalent model where instead of going in and measuring those individual spins, we're just going to put on some local fields or some local perturbations that's then going to drive the computation adiabatically from its input to its output. And so even though I'm going to focus on this measurement-based model, I want to point out that there's some nice results by Dave Bacon and Steve Flamia very recently, which show that we can think of taking a ground state of a many-body system and subjecting it to some local perturbations that's going to drive the computation in a way that's completely equivalent to this measurement-based model. So it makes sense to talk within the framework of this model. Okay, so I said I'm going to give you some specific details of how this works, and I'm going to focus on one dimension, which is going to give you the essential ideas of how things work. It's much more complicated in two dimensions, but the essential techniques are the same. So I'm going to take a spin chain. A spin chain is composed of spin half particles, or qubits. And I'm going to think of some interaction Hamiltonian on this spin chain, given by the top expression there, the sum of a bunch of terms that involve a sigma z, which I'm just going to denote z, on a qubit, sigma x on its neighbor, sigma z on the next neighbor. So three body interactions. You can check that all of those terms commute, so this has a nice property of being a frustration-free Hamiltonian. I can find the ground state very easily by just finding the ground state of each individual term, and that is going to be what I define to be my cluster state. So a cluster state is the ground state of this designer Hamiltonian, this toy model Hamiltonian that I've just put up. And how do we think of doing quantum computation on this ground state? Well, let's think of the simplest elementary thing we would want to do in a computation, which is just to move some quantum information encoded as a qubit down a wire. How would we do that within this model? Well, within the measurement-based model, all you have to do is measure this system in the x basis, measure each spin in the x basis, and what happens after that is that you've created a maximally entangled state between the outer two qubits, and we can then use that state for teleportation of our quantum information down that wire. And if you don't like to think in terms of measurements, again, you can just apply local fields and have a similar effect occur. So this idea of doing a quantum wire is a key property that we want in our quantum computer. And so I'm going to ask, okay, well, for this particular Hamiltonian that I've defined, and it has these nice exactly solvable properties, I can do I can make a qubit wire, I can move quantum information down that wire. What general properties of a system are required in order to make it a qubit wire? What are the general properties, the essential properties of this system that I can ask to maintain as I perturb it, as I look at similar systems, such that I still have that ability to use it as a wire? Okay. What I'm going to argue is that some symmetries of this model will be sufficient for us to pinpoint the desired the properties necessary for a system to be useful as a wire in this sense. Okay, so here's a particular symmetry that this cluster state model has. Obviously, it has a whole bunch of symmetries just given by the terms of the Hamiltonian, but I'm going to focus on a specific sort of global symmetry on this model. to do this, to define the symmetry, I'm going to color this line with two colors, red and blue, because I'm going to act differently on red sites than on blue sites. I'm going to define a Z2 cross Z2 symmetry. That's just a simple group consisting of four elements, one of which is the identity, one of which is I'm going to, so that's the do-nothing term, the identity term in that group. One is I'm going to flip all of the red spins, flip them around the x-axis. I want my system to be invariant under that transformation, and you can check this Hamiltonian is. The other one I want to do is flip all the blue ones. It's invariant under that transformation as well. And of course, I can also flip the red and the blue, and that closes to a nice group, Z2 cross Z2. It's this symmetry which I'm going to argue is the defining property of a qubit wire that we're going to need. The cluster state has that property. More generally, what states are going to have that property? Okay. So to describe more general states than this particular one, I should have mentioned that this action of this group makes me naturally group together a red and a blue spin together and think of them as a single site, because then I can think of this group as acting as some on-site symmetry group of this lattice. Okay, so I've grouped together these spins, and I want to now say what general properties of a system will have that same symmetry. Systems meaning states that are ground states of some spin chain, some general spin chain. How do we describe states of a general spin chain? Tensor network states are the natural language by which we would describe ground states of gapped spin chains in one dimension, or in higher dimensions, but in one dimension in particular. Okay, so what is a tensor network state? A tensor network state says, well, I have to define the state of some spin chain. No laser point. It's all right. To define the state of some spin chain, I need to specify, for n spins, I need to specify 2 to the n coefficients to tell me what that state is in a particular basis. A tensor network state provides you with a nice efficient way to come up with those 2 to the n coefficients through the contraction of some nice number of tensors, in this case just n tensors. So all of the coefficients are determined by downward legs on these tensors, which range over the dimension of the site. And as I said, a site's going to consist of 2 spins, so it will range 1 to 4. And then these tensors will also have some sideways legs, which link up and get contracted in order to define all of those coefficients of the bottom legs. So we can run over any range of values over that contracted index. For the purposes of the cluster state, it's sufficient to just restrict those values to 1 or 2. Those are very, very small tensors, but in general, they can be much larger. Okay. Why am I writing this state as a tensor network state? They're nice, efficient ways to represent ground states of gapped one-dimensional spin chains, but also they are the natural language with which to describe measurement-based quantum computing, and I'll show you why. So I want to take the action of this symmetry group, which I just showed you on a previous slide, and say, what does that symmetry group of the state tell me about how the tensors transform under that symmetry group? Okay, well, if I have an invariant state, that means if I apply this Z2 cross Z2 group on every single leg, that state will be invariant. What does that say about an individual tensor? Well, it doesn't say that the individual tensor must be invariant under that transformation. That individual tensor can transform under that action on that pair of spins of Z2 cross Z2. It can transform in this way with some representation of Z2 cross Z2 on those contracted legs. And you can see if I do that on every single site, I'll always get a TG acting on one side of this tensor and a TG inverse acting on that side, and it will cancel. So if my tensors satisfy this nice covariance property, this gauge symmetry, then the global state will be invariant. Okay. So in what way do the tensors for this one-dimensional cluster state transform? And we can check that because we know these tensors explicitly. I didn't give it to you, but you can trust me on the answer, that these tensors transform non-trivially, that this representation TG of Z2 cross Z2 is exactly the Pauli group. There's the do-nothing transformation. Here was flip all the red spins. Here's flip all the blue spins. And here's flip both. Those form a representation of Z2 cross Z2. In fact, they form a projective representation of Z2 cross Z2. So these terms cannot commute, even though that is an abelian group. And that's going to be a key property here. So the cluster state tensors transform in this particular way. And now I'm going to argue that this particular transformation property is exactly what makes the cluster state work well as a wire for moving quantum information down a chain. Because now let's think of measuring the cluster state in that X basis. That's what the measurement-based quantum computation sequence told me to do. I'm going to measure that first spin up there. Well, it's a pair of spins, so I measure each one in the X basis. And let me check what happens to the tensor when I do that measurement. So now I'm not applying a group transformation. I'm doing a measurement in a basis that has nice properties under that symmetry group. And you can check. What happens is that, well, I measure that state. It turns into a little product state given by the outcome of that measurement. So I leave that as a little dangling one-index tensor. That's a product state. And what happens to these contracted links? Those contracted links just link up up to the action of a Pauli operator. That TG was either the identity or Pauli X, Pauli Y, or Pauli Z, depending on the measurement outcome. And if I continue to measure down the chain, all in the X basis, I have the same thing happen to all the tensors. All the legs separate off from the state of the outer qubits. And I have linked up the state of those outer qubits through just a continuous contraction up to some group operator. And this is exactly what I need in order to get a maximally entangled state between the system on the endpoints in order to do gate teleportation, in order to send that qubit down the wire. It will get some random Pauli action on it, but we can take that into account. Okay, so this is the key condition we need for a system to work as a quantum computational wire. If this system is described by tensor network states with tensors that obey this particular symmetry, where this representation is the representation of the Pauli group, this projective representation, then the state is a good wire for moving quantum information. Okay, and how does that help us? Well, fortunately, your new colleague, Xiaogang Wen, and his students have shown that there's a complete classification of ground states of spin chains that obey this particular symmetry. What does that mean? Think of any Hamiltonian, which is this cluster Hamiltonian plus some perturbation, even a large perturbation, that obeys this symmetry. The perturbation itself also has to be invariant under the symmetry. So we considered such symmetry respecting perturbations. And here's the classification that he came up with, is that there is no way to connect, without going through some phase transition, states for which the tensors transform under this projective representation of the Pauli group from states that transform under some non-projective representation, whether it's a trivial representation like I've shown here, where each state is a product state, and under the group, nothing happens, or if we had some true representation like a spin one representation, those would also be trivial by that classification. So there is a complete classification of Z2 cross Z2 invariant ground states into two phases under the action of symmetry-protecting perturbations. One is all states will have tensors that transform under that Pauli group and therefore serve as a good quantum computational wire. The other phase, the tensors don't transform under that representation and are useless as a quantum computational wire. That's great, because we've just shown that's the essential property. Wen has done this classification, and it says that there is a phase space of symmetric states, Z2 cross Z2 invariant states, that looks something like follows. There's a trivial phase that includes product states and all things perturbed by it, from that product state. And there's a phase that contains this one-dimensional cluster state and all other perturbations on that state. And everything in that cluster phase works just as good as a perfect quantum computational wire as the cluster state. Okay, well, we can do a wire. What else can we do? Can we do some actual non-trivial logic? Okay, well, that's a trickier question. How do we do logic in the cluster state? That involves doing some measurements in a different basis. To do some rotation gate on a single qubit moving down that wire, we would measure a pair of spins, not in the x basis, but in some general direction in the xy plane. And I won't go into the details, but such a measurement induces a transformation on that wire. And this is generally how things are done when you extend it to 2D, you think of changing the basis of your measurements on different sites depending on what gates you want to do and what type of logic you want to do. Okay, but let's focus our attention again on this one-qubit example, sorry, this one-dimensional example, though these results are going to be generally applicable to higher dimension as well. Okay, so this is the most technical part, but I'm going to very much sort of gloss over the details. So I'm going to observe a property of tensors that respect the symmetry and which transform under this Pauli group. I know that those tensors for a given bottom index look like a matrix connecting the left and right legs. And I know that those matrices transform in a particular way under the symmetry group. So I can always factor the matrix into some nice 2x2 space tensor, some general space. The 2x2 space is completely determined by the properties of this Pauli representation of Z2 cross Z2. And the other space we call the junk space because it involves a whole bunch of degrees of freedom we're not interested in that describe how this system is different from the cluster state. Okay, so the symmetry ensures that we can do this type of factorization. And loosely, we think of the quantum information as moving down now that yellow legs as a wire. And what we want to do is just avoid getting mixed up with the junk space. If we do the sort of standard measurements in the basis determined by that symmetry, that's exactly what happens. And the qubit moves down that yellow path without any interaction with that junk space. If we try to do different measurements, such as to get a rotation gate, then that's not the case. But what we can show is that if you want to do a different type of gate, what happens is we get weakly entangled. We weakly interact the qubit system that we want to preserve with this junk space system. And that interaction depends on that choice of measurement we do. And here I've written in a particular coherent way that makes it easier. So all we've done is a bunch of manipulations of tensor networks. And I'm going to spare you all the details. But what we can do when we put a sequence of these things together is to say, well, as we move along this wire, we're doing non-trivial gates. And we're interacting in a particular way with this junk space, always through the bottom legs. We can just bend the junk space part of that over to the side. And we get a picture that might be familiar to those of you who've ever looked at open system dynamics, that we have a qubit moving along that yellow wire on the top, where we're subjecting it to unitary gates. And it's interacting weakly with systems of some environment. And the key properties are, number one, it's localized in time, as in where we are down this wire. Each system interacts weakly with some different system each time. So we have independence there. And remember that we're free to space gates as far apart as we want. We can put in a perfect identity wire between gates if we want to move them farther apart. And so we can space those things out such that any correlations in this junk space viewed as an environment Well, if we move out far enough, we'll go beyond the correlation space length of that junk space, and we will get a nice Markovian error model, which means it's memoryless. When we interact with each system, it's like interacting with an independent new system each time. So we've managed to reduce this problem of more general logic gates down this wire to a standard model of local independent Markovian noise. And that's the type of thing, when we go beyond a single qubit, we can think of correcting with quantum error correction. And so that's the essential result here. In 1D, we have a nice local independent Markovian error model for doing general gates. In 1D, you can't do anything to correct for that. But these results generalize to two and higher dimensions in a very natural way. And in higher dimensions, you can use encodings, quantum error correcting codes, and things like that to correct for such perturbations. So not only can we use any state in that cluster phase as a quantum computational wire and move information around, but for some region around the cluster state, a region defined by what is your best error correction protocol and a fault tolerance calculation, a region by which in two dimensions you can actually do full quantum logic, fault tolerantly. Okay. So with this toy model, I think we have the essential features of what we're looking for from a quantum computational state of matter. With the ground state of not a particular system, but any system that satisfies some particular symmetries, generic types of spin chains and spin lattices at zero temperature, we can use those things as resources for quantum computing in a robust way that doesn't depend on precisely what state you have. Okay. So I said in the latter part of the talk, I'm going to tell you about some results, not in a toy model, but in some more realistic systems. And in particular, I'm going to focus on some antiferromagnetic spin chains, which have similar properties. Okay, and the technical part of the talk is done, so now I'm just going to try to give you some general results in a bit more of an intuitive way. Okay, so this is a research program I've been doing a number of years with Gavin and Akimasa and Joe. So imagine you have a chain of spin one particles, not qubits this time, but spin ones. And we're thinking of a rotationally invariant type of Hamiltonian on this system. So obviously, spin chains are of interest to condensed matter community. And Haldane conjectured back in the early 80s that the ground state properties of spin one systems are very different from the ground state properties of spin half systems for such rotationally invariant chains. He conjectured, in fact, that for integer spins like spin one, you have a gapped ground state. To prove this conjecture, Affleck, Kennedy, Lieb, and Tasaki in the late 80s solved a particular rotationally invariant spin one chain. So we have a Heisenberg type coupling between pairs, and then also the Heisenberg squared type coupling with particular coefficients that made this a nice problem to solve. And they solved this model and showed that it was indeed gapped, giving supporting evidence for this Haldane conjecture. And what does this state look like? Well, they solved this by, I won't describe the details, I'll just tell you, they solved this by constructing what I think is the first tensor network state application to a condensed matter system. They showed that the ground state of the system can be written as a matrix product state, a particular type of tensor network state, where we think of virtual pairs of spin half particles in singlets projected down to spin one. The main point here is that, okay, well, they've described it as a tensor network state. Let's look at the properties of this tensor network state under a relevant symmetry group. What symmetry group am I going to look at? I'm going to look at the symmetry group, the subgroup of the rotation group, SO3, that involves pi flips about the x and y and z axis. That group, D2, the dihedral group, is the same group as Z2 cross Z2. So if we think of that as a Z2 cross Z2 action on these matrices, the state is invariant. We ask, how do the tensors transform? What are those gauge transformations, T of G? And the answer is, it's the Pauli representation. This is exactly the same transformation properties that the cluster state obeyed. This AKLT state is, in fact, another representative state within this thing I called before the cluster phase, the phase where all ground states are useful as a perfect quantum computational wire. And just to add a few more details to this phase diagram, a spin one ferromagnet, where all the spins are pointed in the same direction, that's a product state, that's over on that side. But a spin one antiferromagnet, a Heisenberg coupling, without that quadratic term, that sits quite firmly in this phase, which we can now call the Haldane phase, because that's the standard terminology from condensed matter physics. Any ground state in that Haldane phase is a perfect wire for the purposes of quantum computation. And we can also use similar techniques that what I described for that toy theory to think about doing robust gates. So without going into any details, I'll just give you some references to say that there's been a chain of research as we've understood these systems better and better to think about how you could take a generic state within that phase defined only by the symmetries and come up with a way of applying local fields or other local perturbations to drive the computation in that ground state in a way that enables universal quantum logic in a robust way. So we have some quite positive results on using generic properties of states in that Haldane phase, rather than saying I need a very particular state that's the ground state of some very particular Hamiltonian. Okay. So all of this stuff is restricted to one dimension. And so let me conclude very briefly with some results on how things extend to two dimensions. Because it's only in two dimensions can we do more than just say, let's move a qubit down the wire, or let's act on it with some rotation gate. We want to interact multiple encoded qubits and do more general types of quantum logic. And for that, we need a ground state of a two or higher dimensional system. OK. So there's a 2D cluster state. It's the ground state of a toy model. There's the Hamiltonian. It now involves these five-body terms. Measurement-based quantum computation on that can be mapped over to an adiabatic version of it. And these are these results of Dave Bacon and Steve Flamia that I alluded to. So if you have exactly that cluster model, and you can do the type of quantum computation with the ground state that we've been talking about in this talk. So really, the question here is, well, how robust is this 2D state to local perturbations? Is there a 2D cluster phase that generalizes these results we had in 1D? And this is still very much an open question, because classifying, well, first of all, extending Wen's classification to two dimensions and trying to understand all phases of various symmetry-protected states in terms of the properties of their tensors, that's an ongoing research program that hasn't quite reached its conclusion. And it's not even clear, actually, if there's as strong a connection between doing quantum logic and those symmetry-protected extensions in 2D as there was in 1D. So it's still very much an open question. We do have some positive results for particular types of perturbations. But whether these 1D results exactly extend to two dimensions, ongoing research. But let me tell you a bit about one particular positive result in not a cluster state, but again, a more realistic antiferromagnetic type system. And that's a 2D generalization of this AKLT state. In two dimensions, we're going to use spin 3/2 particles. And by extension of how we defined the AKLT state on a chain, we're going to define an AKLT state on a honeycomb lattice of spin 3/2 particles. It's the unique ground state of a Hamiltonian. Unfortunately, it's even difficult to prove in this 2D system whether that Hamiltonian is gapped. But we can at least look at some properties of the long-range correlations that exist within this particular type of system. And it's antiferromagnetic, but it is not Néel-ordered, meaning that it's not the simple state where half of the spin three halves are pointed up and half of the spin three halves are pointed down. Okay? It's a much more exotic antiferromagnetic state that involves entanglement between all of those different spins. Okay, so very exciting results just, well, of last year, published this year by Akimasa and also Zuchi Wei and Efflick and Rob Rausendorf on how we can use this ground state to do measurement-based quantum computing. And the basic idea is we subject this ground state to some filtering measurements. Based on the outcomes of those measurements, we decide to color each spin three half either yellow, blue, or red. And then there's a conversion sequence by which we can classically process the outcomes of that filtering measurement to construct a random cluster state, as in a cluster state defined on some random graph. And then you look at the connectivity properties of that graph, and you say, we can convert that AKLT state into a cluster state with exactly the type of connectivity properties that would allow for measurement-based quantum computing. So that's the result of Akimasa and Wei, Affleck, and Rausendorf from last year, that that particular state, ground state of that particular Hamiltonian, is a universal resource. And we want to ask the question, is this state also robust against perturbations? Rather than looking at all particular perturbations, we're going to look at a particular class of perturbations. I won't give you the details of how we vary the Hamiltonian, but we have a one-parameter family of Hamiltonians that can take us from a point where the ground state is at 2D AKLT state through a phase transition to a Nielle-ordered type state, which we expect to be useless for quantum computation. And we want to say, how does this conversion algorithm from taking that state to the cluster state, how can we adapt that and apply it to more general states within that phase? Okay, the essential results are going to be illustrated just pictorially. We're going to modify our filtering operation by which we do some measurements and decide to color these spins. And we're going to say, well, how does it work as we apply it to different states throughout this one-parameter family? At the AKLT point, we get equal probabilities of all the three colors. As we move away from that, we get different distributions of those outcomes. And then the question is, can we convert those different states into a cluster state? And what we find as we go through that conversion algorithm, exactly as my colleagues have defined, is that when we're in that state containing the 2D AKLT phase, we produce a random cluster state again, and its connectivity properties will be generally like the desired 2D cluster state on a square lattice. We'll be able to use that state for measurement-based quantum computing. And then at the phase transition, the connectivity properties of the resulting lattice change quite drastically. We don't have a genuine 2D type lattice anymore with lots of different paths crossing it in both dimensions. We get things that become a bit more like star-like graphs. And that suggests this type of state is not going to be useful. Without going into exact details of what I'm plotting here, we have, by numerically investigating the statistics of this system, what we've shown is applying this modified filtering algorithm within the phase, with high probability, leads states that are useful for measurement-based quantum computing. And if we tried to apply that filtering operation to states at the phase transition or beyond into that Nielle-ordered phase, we find that those properties disappear. So there's a suggestion right at that phase transition boundary that we have a resource which is transforming itself from a universal resource for measurement-based quantum computing to a non-universal resource. Okay, so we expect that we have a phase diagram a bit like this. There's what they call in the condensed matter literature a disordered phase. It's not Nielle ordered, but it has the type of long-range correlations we need for measurement-based quantum computing. And any state, certainly along that line up to that red line, will be useful for measurement-based quantum computing. There's a phase transition, and over here we have states that are not useful. A distinction from that 1D example is now the Heisenberg Hamiltonian of these spin 1 particles with nearest neighbors. is over in that nail ordered phase, in this useless phase. So one does not expect that particular Hamiltonian to have a ground state that's useful. Okay, so that's a positive result, but I want to emphasize in 2D, we still don't have a good characterization of what are the general properties of a ground state that will allow you to use it as a quantum computer in the same sense we understand for the 1D case. Okay, so that really brings me to the end of my talk. Just a bit of a summary of what we've learned here. So it does make sense to think of the ground state of a quantum many-body system, or looking ahead, even the low temperature thermal state of a quantum many-body system, as having at equilibrium the types of long-range correlations we need in order to use it as a quantum computer. In 1D systems, we have a very strong classification of exactly what these properties are. And surprisingly, it is identical to a phase of anti-ferromagnetic spin chains that have been investigated now for a couple of decades. And a lot of those ideas seem to extend to 2D, but that full classification is still open. So the real question we have, as people like Wen and his collaborators extend these ideas of symmetry-protected order to two dimensions, to say whether those properties are precisely the types of properties we need of a 2D system to allow for quantum computation. Okay, and I'll leave it there. Thank you very much.
What is the simplest mathematical operation we can do with the quantum computer, for example, in your toy model?
Are you talking about in the one-dimensional or the two-dimensional?
The one-dimensional.
Yeah. So the one-dimensional one is essentially quite boring, unless we supplement it with something else. So all you can do is send a qubit down a wire, and if you want, you can do arbitrary rotations, unitary operations on that qubit. That alone doesn't let you entangle two different qubits. But if you imagine supplementing a bunch of such chains with some additional interaction, an interaction like a CNOT gate built in the more standard version of quantum computing, then such chains can be supplemented in a fairly straightforward way to do universal quantum computing. And that means you can do anything that a quantum computer.
Yeah, so what about the three-dimensional case? So in particular, like the AKLT state is about solid state matter and so on. So would that change anything to going to 3D structures, or is it the same?
So a lot of what I said about 2D, I guess, could be broad to say it's about two or higher dimensions. The larger dimensions are just as unclassified as the two-dimensional ones, but we're hoping there's the expectation if people understand a 2D problem, that's largely going to solve it for larger dimensions as well. Now, there's the reason one is interested in three-dimensional structures, other than the fact that, well, we have three dimensions, so perhaps we should use it, is the idea, again, due to Rausendorf and his collaborators, that with three-dimensional things, the quantum information that's moving through your bulk now. As I said, when we go to two dimensions, we can think of encoding a bunch of qubits moving through that bulk into an error-corrected code. If you go to three dimensions, you can encode that quantum information into topological codes, which are on two-dimensional surfaces within that three-dimensional bulk. So in the measurement-based model, currently proposals based on using such topological codes in this 3D bulk give us some of the best thresholds we have for quantum computing. When people say now thresholds are up near 1%, it's because of that model, among some other results. If you're looking for high thresholds, there's the hope to go to 3D and to use some of those ideas. Mm-hmm.